The following chat is with Rossi, an ecologist and tour guide who travels around Cape York, northern Queensland, where he takes his guests on a journey connecting them back to nature, but also stepping them back in time, where Rossi shares more about the history of this rugged, untouched land. But one thing I really loved about this conversation is learning more about Rossi's Step Outside program, where he works with our youth, getting them away from technology and back to themselves. I really did love this part of our conversation. I hope you enjoyed the following wild chat as much as I did. Have you ever wondered how a kangaroo can live in a tree? Or what about crocodiles and how they can stay underwater for hours at a time and not be seen? Maybe what keeps you up at night is your thoughts of how box jellyfish can be the most venomous animal in the whole world towards humans. Or is it your curiosity of what really goes on inside that caterpillar cocoon for a magnificent, stunning butterfly to emerge? Well, don't worry, as I have all your questions answered and much, much more with our following Wild Chats, I am going to bring you the most amazing guests. Hey everyone, my name is Jody Creek and I'm a wildlife educator and huge advocate for Australian animals. And of course, their habitats and ecosystems as well. But what I'm truly passionate about is bringing you information that you need to connect with the natural world. So someone once said to me that I may not be able to change the world, but I can change the world around me. So let's hope that we can inspire you to make change at home, and therefore together we do actually change the world. So get that cup of tea ready and enjoy the following Wild Chats. Right, here we are. Hello, how are you?
Good, thank you. How are you?
Good, good. Everyone, we have Rossi here from Cockatoos. And, oh, and we've got Matt.
G'day.
You're always a third wheel. Sorry about that.
There you go.
Well, thanks for coming to hang out with us this morning.
Yeah, absolute pleasure.
Yeah, so we actually first met you. We've been following you for a little bit, but we first met you the other day. And when we were sitting here and we're having a bit of a chat and we're in the garden, I was like, I've got to get you on this podcast. So, yeah, awesome. Thank you for coming along. But did you want to say anything, Matt, before?
Yeah, welcome to our backyard.
it's a drizzly old
wet season morning in North Queensland, but we wouldn't have it any other way.
It's a fine wet tropics morning. It's absolutely fine morning.
It's actually misty. Like, look at, we've got this misty rain, which is really odd for Cairns. Usually it's just pouring now. Mm. Yeah, beautiful though. You can hear the cockatoos in the background. But anyway, we didn't get you here to talk about our garden necessarily, but...
Maybe after the podcast we can talk about our garden.
Well, it needs some weeding. Needs some weeding. But Rossi, tell us a little bit about, well, who you are, what do you do? I did mention cockatoos, but I'd really love to know a little bit more about that. And I know our listeners love the journey of someone. So, yeah, just... Take it away. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Absolutely. Sounds good. So, yeah, good morning, everyone. Welcome to this fine podcast. I'm very excited to be here. This is my first podcast ever. So, yeah, great experience for me. My name's Rossi. My name's Brian. First name's Ryan. Last name's Ross. But, yeah, everyone calls me Rossi. Yeah, I guess I'm an outdoors, eco-based bushy, really. But I'm just a down-to-earth kind of bushy. So I grew up... Luckily for me, and it was a great experience, I grew up in Bamaga as a kid with my brother, and I was from 2 to 6 years old there, so it was really good. Bamaga's an Indigenous community at the top of Cape York in Australia, if anyone doesn't know, and I was lucky to live there as a kid, and Mum was a teacher, Dad was a fishing guide, so we got the full outdoors experience,
yeah,
and then moved to Tully, and then funnily enough, the one thing that led me to my ecology background was a sport called bow hunting. And I grew up from about 10, 11 years old in a bow hunting club that had really strict morals and ethics on hunting and traditional hunting with wooden bows, and taught us a lot about animals. And so my brother and I spent a lot of our youth and teen years in the bush sitting, hunting, but quite often not being successful. But while you're sitting and hunting, you're observing animals.
Yeah, you would.
So I think in a really weird way to get to an ecology, you know, kind of job these days, I was hunting animals, which took me there. So yeah, throughout my youth, I was hunting with a bow and arrows. And as I got older, I decided to go to university and study ecology or zoology, as sometimes it's called. I kind of call it ecology nowadays because everyone's, when you say zoology, everyone says, oh, which zoo do you work at?
Yeah, people do just think zoology is just the zoos or the animals, specific. So I think, which uni did you go to?
I was at James Cook University in Townsville.
In Townsville, yeah.
Yeah, I've met a lot of people doing podcasts that went to the same uni as me down at Gatton Uni.
Yeah.
So it's like a little old agricultural college west of Brisbane. And, all those people are more sort of working with the horses or the cattle and stuff. Yeah. But then I started the wildlife biology there. That was the first sort of cohort of that.
So,
I usually meet a lot of people around that. But Townsville, hey, but I love what you said before is when you're, you know, what do you call that with your hunting style?
We call it traditional bow hunting.
Bow hunting.
Yeah.
So when you're sitting in nature then and you're obviously having one to be quiet, but then you're like you have to be in tune of where things are coming from and what that sound is from the back, the side, what sounds you're having. Yeah. But then the feeling of, I don't know, I'm getting this sense of like you're sitting in there and that feeling of nature, you're literally laying down, sitting up, like being amongst it completely and wholly. And
absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
It's a pretty wild feeling. I think it's one of the most amazing sports I think you could ever do. One of the guys that taught us, he calls it bushwalking with adrenaline because you are like your adrenaline's peaking at the sound of anything kind of moving or exploding out of the bush, like a little bloody Spinifex pigeons or something. You absolutely crap your axe. It's hilarious. And so it is bushwalking with adrenaline. But yeah, when you're, because you've got to be really in tune with everything, with the winds, where the sun is, where the shadows are, how hot the ground is, because we often hunt with thongs and then you take them off and go barefoot. And so you can't just walk through a patch of sand in 46 degree weather, you know, and walk straight through. Like I burnt my feet multiple times doing that, but a lot of the time you would sit down in the shade and just watch. And we were mostly hunting pigs in, you know, west of Cairns in outback Queensland and Cape York. And so you're going through like billabongs and wetlands and just wild, beautiful country. And you spend a lot of time sitting.
That's it. And you would also get to learn very quickly because I've worked, my background, I worked in zoos, but they were very open exhibit zoos. So amongst, or multi-exhibit. So we had the birds and the mammals and everything, also reptiles all going all at once in the one sort of exhibit. So you get to know where birds sit at certain times of the day, and you get to know when the lizards, and when something is like, you may walk past a bird and you go, hang on a minute, it's January and you're not usually sitting in this spot at this particular time. So did you learn more about that when you were?
No, I think I was too young and I was still more interested in the hunting aspect of it. But I loved the connection with animals, but I didn't really understand birds or anything. I was really into snakes and reptiles then. So I knew most of the snakes around. I didn't know a lot of the skinks or lizards and that, but I was still really excited by a lot of those things.
And so for people who are listening and probably thinking, well, if you are now an ecologist and you're, you know, you do your own business with cockatoos, why would you be hunting and what you were hunting? So you did mention pigs.
Yeah,
so
that's right.
Maybe explain to a little bit, because we do have overseas people who listen and they're thinking, well, why do you want to hunt Australian animals? Can you explain a little bit of why pigs specifically and why that happens?
So in Australia we have a lot of introduced feral species and pigs are one of them. So with bow hunting you're only allowed to hunt feral animals that are in Australia. You're not allowed to hunt any native animals at all. And so I actually came to Crossroads when I was in my late teens about bow hunting because I wanted to go into ecology. And I realised that I couldn't do the sport anymore. And my brother pulled me aside one day and he said, you know, what we're doing is we're essentially saving a lot of native animals by hunting pigs. You know, the pigs are incredibly destructive. They destroy habitat. They spread diseases. They eat turtle eggs. They do all sorts of things. And so I was like, yeah, you're right. And I started learning more about it. And coincidentally, when I was done my undergrad, my 3 years at uni, I did a postgrad honours degree and it was a year of research. And I did my year of research on feral pigs in Lakefield, which is Queensland's Kakadu, essentially. And we studied feral pig diet for a year. And so I learned all about how destructive they were by my own study. And all of those years of watching them and behaviour and that helped my thesis and my honours. So, it was a weird connection, the way through.
Yeah, but that's really cool, though. So what did you find in regards to their diet?
So feral pigs, in the scientific way of putting it, is they eat everything. That is about it. If you want to talk like the scientific phrase, it's they are opportunistic omnivores. But literally, they just eat anything and everything. I found feathers of birds that had a bit of flesh off it, so it had rotted off and the feather had blown away with a tiny bit of flesh. They've smelt it and eaten that whole feather because it had a tiny bit of flesh on it. So their noses are just incredible. And, they just chew anything.
That is amazing. Yeah. And definitely very destructive.
Yeah.
Very, very.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm glad that you explained that, because I didn't want all of our listeners to think that you were out hunting all the native species.
Yeah.
You know, it does happen here in Australia. And
I was pretty fortunate that the bow club I grew up in had really strong moral and ethical views on hunting. And so we got taught from a kid the right way to hunt. Like, we got taught to respect, regardless of the animal you're hunting, you still respect them. Yeah. So the way I look at pigs is a lot different to the a lot of ways other people look at pigs. Like, I have a massive respect for the animal. Most of the time I lose when I was hunting them. But yeah, we always respected the animal, and it was really special. So the guys raises. Yeah, in a really unique hunting way.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
And like you said, you learnt a lot of morals and values
with
that.
Yeah.
So there's a lot to learn in that in itself. Like what you said, respect is a big one.
Huge.
Yeah. Awesome.
Yeah.
That's a great thing to learn as a young man.
Yeah. Yeah, it was wild. Yeah, because I saw the growth of, you know, like, pig hunters and dog hunters in my town, and it was just so different. It was so foreign for me that these young guys were going out hunting without any kind of experience or training or anything, where we'd been trained for 5 or 10 years as kids on how to track and how to, you know, place your arrow correctly, and and like, we'd even down to the fact that you had to take a photo of the animal, because it was disrespectful to not take a photo of the animal because you weren't honouring it. You weren't respecting how majestic that animal was. So
I love that.
Yeah, yeah, it was really strange. Yeah.
And I love the fact that you were learning tracking as well.
Mm.
That's really cool.
Yeah, yeah.
And so all this to then, for you being a tour guide, what a great thing to have. Like, when you are touring around and you are with your group of people up in Cape York or so forth, are you actually using your skills of tracking?
Yeah, absolutely. But I think because I've done it for so long, I forget how valuable it is to other people. And so I see tracks all the time. I'm reading it. My brother's phenomenal. Like, he's done tracking in Africa and is really, really good at it. But I'll see tracks around a wetland and forget that other people, it's not common to them.
Mm.
And so when someone asked me, then I click and remember, I was like, oh, yeah, that's right. People really love this.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I'll start to go into it, and they just, they're frothing on it, you know?
Yeah. So you're on this mission. You're like, yeah, okay, we're going this way and we're going there. I know that there's something over there. And everyone's like, how do you even know that?
Yeah.
So it's really, I personally love it when someone teaches me, like when we're out, you know, this is how I learned as well, when we're out in the rainforest at certain times of the day, and they might know something and I'd have no idea. So they then go on to explain how they found that, and it just opens up the world so much more.
It does.
And you're just like, oh, wow, yeah. So then next time I'm out in the rainforest or so forth, then I will try and remember that. So that's a great thing to be able to tell your guests who are traveling around Cape York or on your tours, and then next time they're out in nature, they're going to remember how you found a specific area or animal or so forth. So yeah, sharing that. We actually forget to do that.
Yeah, absolutely.
It just comes second nature. It just
green ants' nest. Like, green ants' nest is so normal for us up here, and clients see them and they're like, what's that? And I'm like, what do you mean? And I'm thinking it's something more specific in the tree, and they're like, that weird weaving thing. And I was like, oh, that's a green ants' nest. And they're like, oh, we don't have those. I'm like, oh, fair dinkum, you know. It's wild to think that, hey?
Yeah, absolutely. And I learnt more about the green ants' nest the other week with Mini Beast Wildlife. I did a podcast.
Yep.
And we are actually going to do just a talk on ants.
Amazing.
But the green ants, it was so interesting. And now when I see the nest, I won't destroy it.
Yep.
Like, they can be quite destructive in your veggie garden there. Yep. But now I'm just like, I know how long it's taken them to build that and what extent and sacrifice they went to build it. So now I'm just like, you stay right there. You do your thing.
Yeah,
I'll work around you. It's amazing. But even myself learning more and more about nature every single day, it just opens up so much more.
Yeah.
Like, it's really exciting.
I didn't realise until I started, like you, learning about green ants, that I took a photo once of these green ants all holding these leaves together, and they're all straining, you know, the team of them holding these leaves together. They were straining, holding it together, while other workers had to go down to the larvae to get the silk to bring it back up to weave that together.
Yeah.
And so they were waiting for someone that was going for a wander for who knows how long, and I was like, what?
Now you know why I can't destroy one.
Yeah.
I'm just like, you guys have worked hard. If you ever want to learn something about hard work, research green ants.
Yeah, yeah, not wrong.
And teamwork.
Yeah,
teamwork.
Exactly. Yeah.
Awesome. We've taken over the conversation, by the way. But
yeah, I went and made a 3-course meal. It was beautiful. A nice roast dinner, actually. But I'm back now. I'm not sure if I missed too much. But Rossi, mate, we've talked about you growing up in the Cape. You're doing some traditional bow hunting, which is spectacular, and how your passion for wildlife developed. You said you then went to university. and now you run a tour company. I'm assuming there's a fair bit of hard work and education that's gone between those two things.
Yep.
So do you want to give us a bit of a rundown through that?
Yeah, absolutely. So how I came into Cockatoos is a story itself. So after uni, I'd worked for a year, again on pigs, and then went travelling overseas for a couple of years, came back, and then went back to the Cape and worked up in the Cape for another 6 years. And I lived in Central Cape in a little town called Cowan. And I was training Indigenous rangers from a couple of ranger groups from Cowan and Aracoon on how to manage feral pigs and sea turtles, because there's an interaction there where pigs would eat the sea turtles or the sea turtle eggs, sorry, in the nests. And then after that, that finished. There was a six-year contract and that was done. I kind of realized I wanted to start my own business, and so I started looking at what I could do, and I really wanted to get kids outdoors and youth outdoors to show, you know, what is out there in the bush and show and help people connect to the bush where they didn't know how to or how to get out there. And so I started building my own idea of a business, started a company name. And then about probably 6 months into that process, a business called Cockatoos came up for sale. Coincidentally, it was friends from my hometown. And one of the owners had unfortunately passed away in an accident. Yeah, his partner sold the business, and I put my hand up, same hometown. I knew them reasonably well from when we were growing up, and she was more than happy to sell the business to me, because, you know, I had the same kind of passions as he did and same kind of mindset, and so she was really stoked for me to take on Cockatoos. And so I was lucky in that I'd lived in Cape York and I'd managed big projects and understood financial management. All these extra things just fell into place for me to take on Cockatoos. And so with all that Cape York experience, it was really easy for me to take on the Cape York guiding side of it. It was more of a just getting everything up to speed with permits and the business side and all that. But once we hit the road, and history, I had to learn some history, because Cape York is wild. Like, it was essentially Australia's last frontier. It was the last explored place in most of the Cape York. So it had a crazy history with the war. One of Australia's most failed overland expeditions went up there. And so it was really phenomenal. So the history, I caught up on that. And once this tour started rolling, like, people loved having, because I got addicted to the history, but they loved having my history take on things as well as my ecology background.
Yeah.
And so we'd be driving along sometimes. I always say, like, you know, because you run over, like, people run over snakes in the Cape all the time. They don't like them. Which isn't fair, not cool, guys. Or they just, you know, they don't see him fast enough. And so whenever I'd see a snake, I say to my clients, like, sorry, guys, especially we're coming back to camp at night. I say, my eyes roll back in my head. I jump out of the truck and the handbrake's on, but the truck's still moving. And I grab the snake to get it off the road before we run over it or someone else does. And then I bring it over to the truck to show people. And because my eyes are still rolled back in my head, I open the door on the cab. And the first thing I hear is all these screams, like, ah! I quickly shut the door. And then I'm like, all right, that's right. I've got to show them through the window. And I'll show these guys these snakes through the window. And it's great, because most of my clients are 60 to 80 years old. And there's, in that demographic, there's quite a few people with that old, you know, a good snake's a dead snake kind of mentality. And so educating people on snakes and how to see if they're venomous or dangerous is really cool. But yeah, it was quite a journey getting to that point and taking on cockatoos.
The history, because that's one thing that just did not interest me at school or even at uni. I was
same.
Just like geography or science and biology and so forth. But now that I'm older, it's really interesting. I'm so interested in history.
Yeah.
I want to know how we became here and, you know, what this particular area went through.
Yeah.
And I think that when we drive around on the tablelands and even heading out to certain areas that used to just be, you know, back in the olden days, just an area for gold or for so forth, like whatever. But yeah, I'm really interested in history.
Yeah.
So that's, how long did it take you to learn? Because as a tour guide, it's the bigger picture. It's not just one, right, we're going up there, we're going to see the tip, we're going to see some animals and this is what it is. It's taking them on an actual journey.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You've got to give the full historical, culture and ecological tour for that kind of place, especially Cape York. Like, Cape York, for anyone overseas, is a really important place. Like, overseas, Kakadu and the Kimberley get big names, but Cape York is equally up there. It just hasn't got that big international name, but it's probably one of our most remote and hard to access places. The roads are really hard, and telling that story right is really important. Like, the cultural history up there is phenomenal. And obviously, when Europeans came through, there's that really intense cultural clash. But then there was World War II, that some crazy things. There was a nuclear bomb tested in one of the most remote jungles in the world, in Cape York.
Wow, really?
Yeah. So in the Iron Range, They replicated the impact of a nuclear bomb in Cape York and let it off in the pristine jungle of the Iron Range.
Whoa.
Back in, I think, the 70s, 60s or 70s.
Wow. Yeah. Huh.
Yeah, and so there's wild history up there.
Yeah, yeah, so it must have taken you quite some time to learn
yeah.
about all that. And then yeah. to find the right information, like where do you even start to look for all that? Like the Cooktown Museum?
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, go to the museums, but read a lot of posts and you talk to people that have lived up there for years. It takes a long time and you're always learning.
Mm.
You're always finding out more little history stories and you just keep developing your own profile of it. But it is, I was the same, like I wasn't really into history at school.
Mm.
Same thing, I was a science kid, loved science. But now that I'm into history, like it's so fascinating. Mm. You've got stories of people hundreds of years ago when they're having to live off the land, they've got horses with all their supplies and guns, going through places where there was either friendly or unfriendly Aboriginal people. And so it was full thrill, absolutely wild. And that story alone, just being able to tell those stories is chilling. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's quite exciting learning about that. Like if you were to pick up like a Jardine journal or a Kennedy journal and read through it, what they wrote each day in their journals is just mind blowing.
That is so cool.
Yeah.
Yes. I want to read that journal.
I'll give it to her. I've got a copy
please.
Of it. Yeah, yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
love
exciting.
To. Love
yeah.
to.
You said Jardine and Kennedy.
Yeah.
Jardine, obviously, the Jardine River's named after Jardine.
Correct.
And Kennedy,
yeah.
Kennedy Highway and Kennedy Range and all that.
Yeah.
So it's interesting that a lot of these places in North Queensland are dedicated to these early explorers and early pioneers, which is pretty awesome. Mate, this is really, really off track here, but I'm just going to throw it down. I've been waiting to ask this question the whole time, and now is probably the best time to do it. How many people can you sit in one chair?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, you need to explain.
No, no, no. I want Rossi to explain
so
this.
So we've literally gone from history to now. Let's just
This is the coolest question ever. Because so this is important for Rossi's development. And you'll see. Just sit there, Jody, and listen up. This is a quick
context for everyone listening. In 2005... our school broke a Guinness World Record for the most people sitting on one chair. How many people do you think you can sit in one chair?
Oh,
before
school,
I read this,
a school chair.
I was going to say, what kind of chair? Okay, a school chair.
I would guess like five. That is before I read this.
Hang on, let me go.
It's ridiculous.
Yes. 12, 12, 15. Yeah, yeah. So not even close.
What?
Like you might as well multiply it by nearly 10.
What?
Or more? No, even more. Yeah. By 50. So we got, I don't know, maybe my math's wrong. We got 508 people sitting on one chair.
How's
income.
That even possible?
Yeah, it's wild. So do you want to know the story?
Yes.
Okay. So I was school captain when I was at Tully State High School, and myself and the female school captain and another bloke there, Morgan, we started just throwing ideas like, come on, we've got to do something to bring the school together. There was a bit of drift, a lot of disconnect. I said, let's do something the whole school can like get involved in. And I think Morgan was like, man, let's break the Guinness World Record, because we always open up the Guinness World Records book, because I was a kid, you know, in that day. It was funny.
Greatest book ever.
Yeah, the biggest bum or the longest this or the whatever that or, you know, whatever was going on, the longest snake. And then we found this one that was like the most people sitting on one chair. And I think at that time it might have been 400. It was held by a school overseas somewhere. And so they said, let's try and break the Guinness World Record for the most people sitting on one chair. And I was like, yep, let's do it. And bam, I'm into action. Like, I'm researching it. What do we need to do? I was talking to guys at, like, I was 17 or something, talking to guys in London from Guinness World Records. Hey, mate, yeah, g'day. We want to break a world record, you know? Oh. And so, yeah, we went through with it, organized a school. It took a few practice attempts because we so the way it works is you've essentially got one of those green plastic school chairs with the four legs.
Mm-hmm.
And because the record was already set, we just had to follow the details of that record
the
guidelines, exactly, yeah. And so all it was one person sat on the chair and then everyone else sat on the person's knees in front of them. And so we had, we got the school together and we tried it a few times. It was actually a leadership building practice that we used to do as well. You know, you get around in a circle, get everyone around in a circle. You have to sit down at the exact same time on each other's knees and you'll be able to support each other sitting around and standing around a circle. And so we did that a few times. What we learned is that you couldn't sit down one after the other. Everyone had to sit down the same time because we tried, 500 people sitting down one after the other. And by the time the last person sat down, that person on the chair was
almost been sitting there for a week.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Their legs are gone. Yeah, mush. And so, yeah, after a few practice runs, and we eventually decided on the day, and we had to get X amount of officials from the town in Tully to come in to verify it. And yeah, we had 508 people in a line sit down at the exact same time, hold it for, I think it was 60 seconds. And yeah, we got verified to break a world record of like 508. I think it's been broken again. It has. I think it's up over 1,200 now.
You know what we need to do? Yeah. What? We need to go to Tully. We need to break this world record.
No way. Imagine it. Yeah, so good.
Keep it in mind. We will make this happen. The reason I ask about all the chair and the sitting and the craziness is because it seems as though this kind of leadership at school is sort of what propelled you forward. I understand then you got accepted into the Young Endeavour Youth Program and you started to build a bit of leadership in youth,
yay,
which obviously has transpired into your growth and how you became essentially a leader in the community. Mm-hmm. And I understand you received an Order of Australia medal.
Yeah, that was, I guess it's a tricky one because it was an Order of Australia medal given on the Young Endeavour, isn't as cool as the normal Order of Australia medal, but it was for exceptional leadership on the boat.
That's a really cool one.
Yeah.
That's
so awesome. We went on the Young Endeavour. If you're a young person, I think, I can't remember what the age is, 17 to 23 or something like that, apply to get on the Young Endeavour. It's one of the best things you'll ever do. I did Hobart to Hobart. So we essentially sailed north from Hobart up the east coast of Tasmania and back down. And as a land-based kid, we went through a place called Storm Bay, and I think the swell was 8 to 10 metres.
Oh.
So the top of the mast of that ship.
Truth. I didn't even know waves got that big.
Yeah, it was. I was the first one to spew, and I spewed for a good 24 hours.
I feel sick thinking about it.
We have now mentioned poo and spew in one podcast. This is going the right
quality
way.
Yeah, you know it's a good podcast if poo and spew is mentioned.
That's what happens when you speak about wildlife and nature.
Yeah.
Okay, and another thing I want to ask you, because I'm just going to keep throwing all these curveballs at you, is this could be the most Australian thing I've ever read in my life. You picked bananas so you could travel around the world.
Oh, yeah, fair dinkum. Yeah, proper. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, proper. That's now the most Australian thing I've heard today.
Yeah.
It's like saying,
tell me about that. You've travelled to 39 different countries in five different continents.
Yeah.
And you picked bananas
to pay
for your travels. That is unbelievable.
Yeah, so if you are from Tully or Innisfail or a lot of the towns up here, and you're a kid going to school and you want money, you'll probably find yourself working on a banana farm through school holidays and then university holidays. I remember my first job on a banana farm was I was doing irrigation, pulling like poly pipe down through the banana rows, 13 years old, getting paid like $8 an hour. Oh, and I saved
the
up.
The richest kid at school.
Oh, mate, balling. I saved up, get this, to buy. Kids this day will just, this will blow their minds, a week's wages, so I think that was $320 or something, to buy a CD burner. A week's wages to buy a CD burner.
Most people probably don't even know what a CD is these days.
That's a scary thought, right?
Yes, that is a scary thought.
I'm 32, by the way, guys. Like, I'm not old. I'm not ancient. Yeah.
Oh, I am.
That is hilarious. And tell us about some of these countries you've explored. 39 different countries. That's a phenomenal effort.
Yeah, it was, I guess. Yeah, it just chipped away at it over time. I got the travel bug pretty early, went to Nepal. Well, still today, my favourite country I've ever been to. Just a beautiful, and you have travellers there, not Instagram holidays. You've got real, genuine travellers, people there to see the culture and that. So went to Nepal, really got the travel bug there. My mum was a traveller and so was my older brother. And then much later on, I decided to take a motorbike over to South America and ride South America to Alaska on my motorbike. And that's where I ticked off a lot of those countries there.
Amazing.
So,
So how do you get a motorbike from here to there?
Yeah.
You ride it across.
Just send it.
Straight across the Pacific Ocean.
Just real fast.
I struggle with the amount of suitcases that you have to take for a family, let alone a motorbike.
Yeah.
So but what gave you the inspiration to do that? Like, yes, your family's travellers, but you were just like, that's it, I'm going to use the motorbike.
Yeah, so that was it was a series of unfortunate events, I think, or fortunate, whichever way you want to look at it. But I was in Nepal, I couldn't really ride a motorbike, hired a motorbike there for 3 days to drive around and see different places in Nepal, and left that shop, like, and that guy was like, he's either dead or my motorbike's done or whatever, and left, had an amazing time in Nepal riding around 3 days.
Wow.
Years later, I was like, I want to go backpacking through South America. And then I just thought about the amount of bus stops and the amount of planes you had to catch and how much lost time and how much you'd actually miss in the back country. You know, the back country of Australia is absolutely magical and same overseas.
Yeah.
And so I was like, what if I hired a motorbike over there? And then that idea just grew, it snowballed.
That was Max.
That wasn't me.
Max, our eclectus parrot, literally just said, hey, how you going? I'm not sure if he just woke up, but we have been talking for quite a while, Max, and we are well, thank you.
He's just, he's interested gold. In your chat.
That's gold. Good on you, Max. What a lad.
Not sure if that made that on the podcast then, but anyway. And how long were you travelling for on your motorbike?
It was 2 years, yeah. So I worked for about 9 months of that, so about a year and 3 months, I think. Yeah, I was travelling on the motorbike.
And how old were you again when you left Australia to go do that?
22.
22.
Yeah, pretty young. Like, looking back, now I'm 32, looking back, I'm like, man, I thought I knew a lot then, but geez, I'm lucky, I reckon, to make it through that trip. Yeah,
wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
But, yeah, saw some amazing things. So to answer your original question, you fly your motorbike. You can either put it on a ship, but it takes a long time. Yeah. But Qantas Freight.
Wow, dead set. Really?
Yeah.
So I actually would have thought you'd stick it on a boat. And just
But it takes too long. Like, you're talking a month, 2 months, that kind of thing. Right. It's cheaper, but it takes a long time. Within 10 days, my motorbike was over there. So from Brisbane to Santiago in Chile. So that's on the west coast of South America. And I got my bike from the airport. It was a bit of like lots of paperwork and that sort of thing. Figured it out and got the bike, and then I was riding south. Yeah, went to the southernmost point of South America and made my way back up north through all the South American countries, Central America, and then up to Alaska. Funnily enough, there's no road in between South America and Central America, so essentially between the two continents, just jungle.
Wow.
And so you have to go to Colombia and catch a boat with your motorbike through these. Like, imagine the islands when you see them in a cartoon, that guy that's stranded on an island with one palm tree, thousands of those. It's called the Sandblast Islands, and they are stunning. So, yeah, caught a boat, a catamaran with over 5 days through there, and, made it to Central America, and they kept that going.
That is amazing.
Saw incredible wildlife too on the way, yeah.
What was your – I actually don't like it when people ask me this, so I'm just going to ask you that, but what's your most favourite moment in that whole trip, wildlife or ecology-based? I know you would have had lots of life moments. Yep. That's just a given, really, when you think about it.
I'll do a 3-2-1 off the top of my head, and these could get rearranged, but one was being in Bolivia in the Amazon and finding a coral snake. That, for me, was absolutely huge. Like, I looked down next to my motorbike, there's a coral snake, and I was just like, wow. You know, growing up, hearing about coral snakes, they were the most dangerous things. You saw them in movies, and so that was really cool. Two was... probably seeing a sloth on the road. Because you see, just riding along.
How is that not number one?
I don't know. That was, it was just...
a sloth in the middle of the road.
Yeah, just...
So did the question... Oh, I'm sorry, I'm just going to have to cut you off here. The question does have to be answered. Why did the sloth cross the road?
I don't know what he was doing. There was obviously a girlfriend over the other side.
It took him 6 weeks to
it
cross.
It would have taken him 6 weeks fanning him to cross the road. He wasn't going fast at all. And I think I might have even moved him because he was like right in the middle of the road. And as everyone knows, like, sloths are really slow.
Slow, yeah.
So seeing one of them on the road riding through, you know, South America was just like, wow.
Wow, that is
that's
an
really
outstandish
cool.
moment.
Yeah. And one, it's probably like for everyone else, it's probably less exciting, but one for me, growing up, I loved the Amazon. And so for my birthday, I just made sure that I was in the Amazon for my birthday, and I went down to this kind of nature park, conservation park, and I was in the Amazon on my birthday, absolutely hammering down rain, and I'm just standing out there, no raincoat, just going, I'm in the Amazon, and this is just real. So that was just being in the Amazon was probably one of my highlights.
Hope you're in your birthday suit.
Oh, pretty close to it.
You can't stand in the middle of the rainforest
without really
taking it all in.
It's the Amazon. I was probably afraid of, like, getting some weird caterpillar or something, you know?
I believe there's a fish that can actually affect men, but we'd probably keep that for another podcast.
That's amazing. A very quick announcement to make that I'm so excited. Our home education virtual portal is up and running, and you can visit that at www.australianwildlifeeducation.com. And if you are a parent or you know other parents who have children ages 4 to 12, this one is specifically for them, and they get to learn more about Australian wildlife. And so do you feel that journey, I mean, 2 years going around and just being in your own moments so many times being on a motorbike. What you mentioned it the other day, you call it helmet time.
Yes.
So do you think, and then plus how you grew up, growing up in Bamaga, it wasn't it? Mm-hmm. And then learning your bow hunting.
Yep.
The morals and the values and the respect and the discipline.
Yep.
Do you feel that that then has set you up as the tour guide you are today?
Absolutely, yeah. Every one of those little pieces of the puzzle has contributed to, I think, get me to where I am now. Like, yeah, the bow hunting was a huge, huge part of everything, to be honest. That was, if I could say anything has defined me as a person more than anything else today, it'd be bow hunting. And not the hunting, not the side people see of it as the killing,
yes,
but the morals, the respect, all that behind it. Yeah.
The connection. When you were talking about it, I actually, because, you know, I'm a mom, I've got a teenage daughter, and so therefore we're around that teenage kind of life. Mm. And I feel that the teenage life now in 2021, we're in now, is so much different to what it was like for me growing up. I'm 41, yeah. So for me growing up, but even for yourself, you grew up in, you know, Northern Australia. And there are parts of the cities where a lot of kids have never even seen the bush. I mean, Matt, you've had people on your tour who are teenagers who have never been to the bush, and they're from Sydney or Melbourne or the cities of Australia. I just got this feeling of it's so needed for our teenage boys specifically to do exactly what you did as a teenager, to then have that. And it's not even about respect for others. It starts with yourself.
Yeah.
And then that goes on to everything else around. And I feel that, you know, there's a lot of talk now about men's circles and about things like that, getting the boys out into the bush and so forth. So it's, I feel that when you're talking about it, that is so needed.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's what you were thinking of with one of your businesses.
You've pretty much nailed it. Exactly, okay. Yeah. So the original company that I created when I was, you know, I'd left that job and I was just starting to make my own business, it was called Step Outside Industries. And that's still the company that holds Cockatoos now. And so exactly what you just said is pretty much the reason why I started Step Outside Industries. I realised that my brother and I had a really unique experience growing up. Like, for me, I was a little bit different at school in that I was, well, A, I was different, but B, like, my school holidays were, I was working on bananas to make money, or I was out bow hunting. Like, they were the two things I got excited for school holidays. I was never not working or hunting in school holidays. And so I realised that, you know, as we got older, my brother and I, that we had a lot to give, and people were starting to tell us, like, you've got to share this.
Absolutely.
And that's what I started. Like, I developed an itinerary for 3 days to take youth out bush. Had a lot of interest. And then when Cockatoos came along, that kind of took precedence because we had to establish the foundations of that first. Mm. And now we've just, we've got two trucks now, and we're starting to try and run, or we're starting to run these school camps again, or youth camps where.
It's amazing.
Yeah, exactly. We take kids out bush. We show them the stuff, you know. And it doesn't, like, odd, like, technology is a big battle we have, but I am in full agreement with the fact that we need it. It's just finding that balance. Mm. Like, you've got to be able to, these days, be able to use an iPad, a phone, a computer. But look at, like, a camera. Like, look at Matt, for example. Like, he, one of his connections with nature is through his camera. And if you find someone that's really good with computers, whatever, and a camera, like, everyone has a camera in their pocket these days, you can use that connection of photography to connect to nature. So,
yeah. Absolutely. It's the, I think I have the word right, but it's the initiation into manhood that I was thinking about when you were talking about that. Sorry that I actually didn't read that part of your website where it's the Step Outside Yourself program. That's the one thing I missed. But literally as you were talking about it, that's what's come up for me, mainly because of being a mum of teenage children, but then also being amongst, because I work in education, being amongst it for the last 20 years and seeing the changes, but also how I sort of grow up. And then with Matt being a police officer now, you know, he comes across a lot of the youth issues.
Yeah.
So I think it's something that is so important, but I'm meeting more and more people who are doing more stuff with men in general, which they hope that it would then pass on to their boys, or they can start their own men's circles or men's group of initiation into manhood. And that rites of passage is really important, I feel. And especially with the disconnection to nature. And yes, because of the computers and the iPads and the TikToks and the, you know, all those crazy things. But it is important in 2021. That is just how it is. And I've been resistant to it completely, even as a parent.
Mm.
But I've had to do work on myself to accept that this is the change.
Yeah.
But how can we still bring in all that within our family and within life and then with the education that we need to kind of pass on to the
kids?
Right, so it's such a big thing, and because of the way you were brought up, what a great thing to pass on to people, to the youth, kids, adults even, so then they know how to do that as parents.
I think it's you make a lot of good points. I mean, one of the things I've found is that it's not that people don't like nature or the outdoors, it's just that it's hard to know how to get out there and connect or how to initiate it, I guess. So I think a lot of what we really want to do is just help people initiate that start. Like, once you get there and you realize what you can do out in the bush, and it doesn't have to be the same as everyone else. Maybe it's just going out to get an Instagram photo for your Instagram. I don't care. That's great. If you're going out the bush and it's for an Instagram photo, that's awesome, because you're going to be out there and you're going to be like, oh, man, this is so recharging, so rejuvenating.
Yeah, and, but on the journey to get that Instagram photo, I'm going to do like kind of guide you and teach you and help you connect.
Yeah, open your eyes, put your phones down for a sec, take that photo when you get there, but this is what we're doing on the way.
Yeah.
I'm going to show you this. I'm going to show you, breathe, take a breath, smell the air, like feel the wind, that kind of thing.
Yeah. And that's one thing, like we're sitting here and I believe it's probably even going to get onto the podcast, but that sound of nature.
Mm.
And this is what, you know, I work in education too, and it's really important. We get to take the animals to the kids, and yes, you can touch and connect with them, but before you do, I'm going to kind of teach you something a little bit about them, but also get you to understand that you can also experience nature at any time, any moment. We're sitting in the backyard and this sound of those insects in the background, and it is being picked up on this podcast, so you may even hear it, but it's about understanding that nature isn't just seen, it's felt and it's heard.
That's amazing.
And I think what's really important is, especially with children, with the stress and the anxiety and the having to get the best Instagram photos and the pressure of making things look perfect, when reality is, like, it's not. No one's life is perfect. I mean, there's still challenges. It's how we deal with it. But being able to sit outside, sit in the ground, even if it's in your backyard, and put your hands in the on the earth and close your eyes, and everything changes.
Yeah.
Like, you're suddenly feeling that connection with where your bottom is sitting and your hands are connecting. You're hearing even the breeze in the trees. You're hearing it. You're hearing the birds. There's little sunbirds flying around, and I can see one over there, and there's one over there.
One tried to make a nest in Rossi's hair before. I was watching it. I didn't want
to
say it.
But it's so important to teach them to slow down.
Yeah.
Let's get the Instagram photo, yes, but the journey to get that,
yes,
enjoy it and connect. Yeah. And with that, as you close your eyes, the pressure of life kind of slows down a little bit, and then you're connecting and feeling and smelling and hearing. And I just think that's something that I know, even for myself at 41, I've been so busy at times, plenty of times, that I forget about that.
Yeah, absolutely.
And teaching our children that side of things is really important. And I'm lucky too to be able to work in education and to help facilitate that. But I feel the work that you do, or that you could do with the youth, even if it's to get that Instagram photo, is so important.
Yeah.
And I hope that you really do, like, go forward with that, because you have a gift, you have something that you were given and taught to you. And how do we pass that on?
Mm.
You know, like, no pressure, by the way. I'm just giving you, like, so you have to
I should have brought a notebook to just take it home and start actioning some of these
just
things.
Listen to the podcast.
Yeah, listen to the podcast. Yeah.
But it's so important. Like, you have the older generation on your tours, and what a great gift that is, being able to learn so much for yourself, which I'm sure you do along your journey. But then what are you learning, and what are you teaching them, and then how can we do that in the off season with so many children or youth or families that actually need that help?
That's right,
yeah.
I think as well, like, a lot of families and people perceive that there's these excessive barriers in between accessing it, and there's really not. And I think one of the other things I've seen is that people expect that their version of nature has to be what everyone else's is. And it's really not like that. Like, your version of nature, especially for a young kid. Like, we did a river float the other day down the backyard just down here, and there's a couple of young boys fishing. Mm. And that's their version of connecting to nature. Your version of nature can be going for a swim. It can be digging for worms. It could be looking for birds. It doesn't have to be – exactly. Mm. It doesn't have to be what everyone else's does. I think the important thing is that we really realize, acknowledge how important it is, even if it's 5 minutes. And I think especially like everyone feels sad at some point in their life, is to realize the importance of going outside your house, going for a walk, down a creek, putting your feet in the water or touching some dirt or something, and, or listening to a bird or feeling the wind. Realizing how important that is so important.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's kind of like a connection with self, like a reconnection with self.
Mm.
Like when you step outside that.
Well, you said the name.
Yeah. Reconnection
with
self.
No, the step outside.
Oh, step outside. Yeah. Well, there you go. Perfect. It is. It's literally stepping outside.
It is. Yeah.
You know, your four walls, your pressures of life. I mean, I just seen that going through with my daughter in year 12. The pressures are coming left, right, and center. Mm. And we are so lucky here in North Queensland. If you have listening to this, if you have not been to North Queensland, seriously, we live in paradise. I'm now looking at, you know, one of the oldest continuously surviving tropical rainforests on Earth, you know, wet tropics rainforest. The oldest. It's crazy. Yeah. And that is my backyard. I am looking at it right now over your shoulder there, Rossi.
Yeah.
And it's like you just said, you just went on a river float. For anyone who doesn't know that, please explain.
Mate, and it's so accessible and easy to do. So
cool.
Just behind us here, there's a bunch of rainforest and a creek called Freshwater Creek, which a lot of locals know well and go and swim at Crystal Cascades. We go out and it can be your tyre tubes from your car tyres, or it can be a $10 Lilo from, you know, Crazy Clark's or whatever it is. Pump it up. You either leave a push bike at one end or a car at one end or your foot falcon back even. But you essentially go up the creek and you take a couple of hours out of the day and you literally put in the creek with a tube or a Lilo and float down and chat with your mates and listen to stuff and just look. And it's just pure silence. Like, it's not near the roads. You don't hear cars. And it's just amazing. Yeah.
I'm just picturing myself laying back, looking up at the surrounding rainforest, like meeting over the top, it's and just wild. That smell and the feel and sitting there going, there's nothing to worry about right now, but whether or not I smash into a rock. But that's it. It's stepping outside.
Yeah.
And I connected further with what it is that why you've called it that.
Yeah.
And I think it's really important. So I love your work. I think it's needed. So Matt, sorry, we took over again. Or I took over again.
Yeah, just went and cooked myself another meal actually. But yes, Struth, how do you follow up from that? I've actually been perusing your website again and reading some of your tours, and I'm a bit bummed that you're actually booked out for a lot of tours next year.
This year.
It's 2021.
We're here.
I'm going to be like that for another month, I reckon. But cockatoos, some of these tours you're operating are just phenomenal. Cape York, Kimberley, photography day tours.
Yeah.
Tell me a bit about cockatoos and what you guys are doing.
So cockatoos was started by that young couple I mentioned earlier in Tully. They just started with the idea of, you know, face your fears, get outdoors, do the fun stuff you want to do, trust us, we're going to give you an authentic experience, and that's exactly what we've continued to run with. So we run Cape York tours primarily, that's our bread and butter, 14 days overland, and they're designed that they're affordable, so they're camping, and it attracts people that...
I just saw how cheap they are. It's,
and I mean, we try and keep it that affordable. Way and adjust, so eventually, you know, we're making money ourselves. To pay ourselves, but essentially we're trying to make sure that they're available to people that really need to get outdoors. Some of the other tours out there, they're accommodated, and you're looking at $8,000 for 14 days or more, depending on what they are. So ours are in a ballpark about $3,000 for about 15 days. Camping tours, so everyone gets to, how's that?
I know.
Sunbirds are back trying to nest in your hair.
Yeah, they're beautiful. A couple of, oliveback sunbirds here just coming in. Male's got his babies tweeting around. He's cute.
Oh, they're so
looking for some nesting opportunities.
They're so cute. And I love the little call.
All right, wait.
Cape York, so we take people, and it's all camping, and so it actually, I always say, like, my clients, I couldn't ask for a better client. They're mostly grey nomads, 60 to 80 years old, but they're true blue. They know it's camping, so they're not they're not kind of prissy and they're really easy going. They just want to have a campfire, tell some lies around the campfire at night,
have
a beer.
How good is a campfire?
Oh, seriously. Amazing. Yeah, it's 14 days of that, like campfires every night.
Sold, I'm coming. 2022, let's do it.
And Cape York's so untouched too. And when you live up there and you've done work up there, you know a lot of secret spots, which is really valuable. Outside of Cape York, we started this year. Running, we wanted to run some tours across the top end and see some other places, and our clients kept on going, you know, let's go to the Territory, let's go to the Kimberley. So we designed a couple of those. So yeah, we're running a Broome to Darwin tour and a Darwin to Cairns tour. But one of the other things we do on the side is we do photography tours and lessons. So with hunting as a kid, we always had a camera on us. You know, from 10, 11 years old, we had cameras on us. And so you're taking photos of not just the animals that you're looking for, but animals that you saw, like geckos and skinks and lizards. Yeah. And so we've been taking photos for years. And as I got older, I was pretty good at math growing up. I understood the technical side of photography as I got older and older and older. And I realized a lot of people taking photos didn't. Even people who are buying DSLRs, they're on auto all the time. And they're wondering why their photos are, you know, washed out or whatever.
Yeah.
And I started just teaching people about it. And then that ended up evolving into lessons and then photography too. So we pretty much do my brother and I run a day photography tour in the wet tropics here. We go up to the Tablelands, visit, wallabies or gorges or waterfalls. And on the way, we teach people the mechanics of what your camera is doing when you're taking a photo. Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah, trying to get people out of auto, pretty much. Yeah.
And you see it so many times. I remember traveling overseas in the past, and there's a bloke walking around with, you know, $20,000 worth of kit, sitting it on auto. And here I am with, you know, my very basic camera. Yeah. Just struggling to comprehend how this bloke can have such an incredible piece of equipment and then just be not treating it to its true value.
That's right, yeah.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
I get really excited teaching people about photography because you can see the little balls drop each time and the puzzle pieces fit in place. And
Yeah, but it's not – because with photography, it's and it's the same with going to get your little Instagram picture – it's about the journey of getting to that point. So you've got your photos of your trip, but what's the journey of getting to that point?
There's always a story behind every photo.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Especially those hard ones. Yeah.
Ooh.
I've got so many yarns that have gone through my mind.
I bet.
From our trips to Amazon and Galapagos and all that kind of stuff. Some of those photos are just a lot of hard work.
Yeah. You should tell us about one of your photos.
Well, I've actually... Yeah, I've got some good yarns I might sprinkle another time. But I remember I photographed an anaconda in the Amazon. So Jody and I went to South America in 2017.
Yeah.
And I said, if we're going over to the Galapagos, I really want to go to the Amazon as well. And my dream was always to see an anaconda. Yeah. You know, you see these movies of this, you know, 30-meter anaconda eating six people. That was sort of, you know, the sensationalistic side of it. Yeah. I actually want to see one in the wild. But, we had no luck when we were there. And I said to this... our guide that was there, he was a traditional hunter from the village, and I said to him, look, if we don't find an anaconda, I'm coming back.
Yeah.
And he said, oh, look, if you come back, don't do this, you know, tour that you're on at the moment, because it's quite a high-end tour. It's you got to come back and do an authentic trip. And I'm thinking, this is what I want. So actually touched base with him again, and a year later I went back and spent 2 weeks camping with this bloke.
Nice.
And the locals of Ecuador. And we ended up finding an anaconda as a brilliant yarn that will take me 3 hours to rattle off, which I'm not going to,
but
finally when we got that anaconda, you know, we got the photo of it cruising through the mud, and just every time I look at that photo, it just throws me straight back to a couple of years ago and the battle it took to actually find one. It was just
Well, you had to come back. It was an expensive one.
Oh, I know, right? It's a very expensive photo. And the coolest thing was cruising through the river eating piranha.
That's the other way around, isn't it?
That's exactly right. So, but no, I won't be going too deep into those yarns.
That's cool. But that just shows, like, a picture is really worth, like, 1,000 words and some.
And some, absolutely.
And so personal. You know, we can share all these photos on Instagram and Facebook, and we can be showing our I remember I came back from Africa years and years and years ago, and I was showing everyone these photos, and my mum was yawning a little bit. She's like, it's just the same. But because I was thinking and believing at that particular time that they would understand the journey of me getting to the point of finally seeing the gorillas. And I'd shown them like 50 photos of gorillas, but that back end story, the personal kind of side of it, no one really gets. And you can tell it over and over again, but until you experience it personally, because, you know, I grew up loving gorillas and here I am trying to share 50 different photos of gorillas and everyone's like, okay, it's the same one.
Yeah.
But I'm like, yeah, look at it this way, and that feeling of what it was like crouching in the mud and then just trying to get out of the way or so forth. So
the sound of the chest beats.
That's so true, yeah.
So the picture, so photos can be very personal, I believe, as well, because of the journey and the point of getting to that point of finally getting your anaconda photo or my gorilla photo.
Yeah.
So true.
I often remember, like, and people, in your case of gorillas, like, I've been shown photos by people before of different things and gone, oh, yeah, that's really cool, you know, great. But if you haven't been there, you don't know. And then years later you go there and then you go back to that person and you're like, tell me about that gorilla again or something. And it's so different when you have that context and you're like, that's, and you get so wound up and excited about it, eh?
Yeah. It's kind of like history, right?
It is like history.
And we're back to the start.
We didn't want to know about history growing up, but now as the journey goes along, we're like, okay, now it's right.
Don't get me started. I will tell you some yarns and I'll get excited. Well, my clients fall asleep on me, but stupidly I do it after a big lunch.
Yep.
And then I tell them one of the most important historical stories of Cape York right after a big lunch, and they're just like snoozing in their camp chairs.
Just remember, you are dealing with 60 to 80 year olds.
That's true.
They do enjoy a nap during the day.
Exactly.
Well, I think we should get you back to tell us a little bit of one of those stories.
We'll do it around a campfire next time.
Oh, that's a great idea.
We'll do that.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's a great idea.
Yep.
And I think, a big shout out to what you do, and because there are people here who are listening from Australia but also overseas. And I think what is really, really, really important in regards to choosing a tour guide or choosing a tour to go along with is, yes, you've got the big companies that get a lot of the press or get a lot of marketing out there, or even within, I'm going to say it, Tourism Queensland. But then people forget about the little people who actually generally I'm not saying the bigger companies don't love what they do, but with the smaller people and with the people like yourself, it's you. You are passionate. You've had the journey. You've learnt so much to get to this point to now wanting to share parts of Northern Australia with people. I think it's really important that everyone's listening is that they do their research on the kind of tours that they're taking.
Yeah.
And is it eco-certified, as I'm now just looking at that?
We're trying to get there, But
even if it's, like, your intention, what are the reviews like as a whole? But, yeah, a little bit more information I think is really important for people when they're choosing the tours because, yes, the history is important and, yes, the ecology and all that kind of stuff, but also who you are. Yeah. And I think your website for everyone, cockatoos.com, really showcases the kind of person you are.
You
kind of walk your talk.
Yeah.
And I think that's really important because there is a lot of things out there in the world where we don't actually walk our talk. We may do a lot of talk, but then what are you doing behind scenes, which is really important. So, yeah, this is why I've got you on, is because I I've only just met you, but I've been following you. Your journey.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, likewise.
Yeah. So I think it's really important for the listeners to definitely consider cockatoos.
Yeah, thank you very much. Yeah, that's great.
If you want to see the tip of Australia or now the Kimberleys and so forth, you can check out all the tours on your website.
And it's pretty evident based on our chat and what we've seen online that your morals and values come before money or wages and income. And as you said, you're offering a service which is affordable because you want these people to be able to experience this part of the world in such a way. And I mean, just having a look online, there's, you know, you do zero plastic, all recyclables, all reusable. You even donate all your cans to charity. Like, it's oh man, you're doing a great job, honestly.
Yeah, thanks.
Big picture.
Yeah, I think I've always said, like, I'm not really interested in money enough to get me by and be able to do the things that make me, which is, you know, my little trips out bush or whatever it is. But if I can give back to the community, that's more important to me than money. And same with the environment. Like, if the reason the tours are cheap is that I know that those people are going to go back and absolutely rave about cockatoos, and they do, and I'll teach them the lessons that I want them to pass on. Like, if I can affect, you know, 70 people a year, whatever it is, through my big tours, and then they go and tell their 70 and then their 70, it becomes exponential. So
yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And so your tours run from which months?
May to September is the season in Cape York in the top end.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's all seasonal up here because we get that big monsoon. Generally January to April is just too wet, and then October, December is too hot and dry.
Yeah.
So, yeah, so May to September is the magic month. Yeah. Months. Yeah.
Definitely. Don't come to – well, if you – hang on a minute. Do come. I love the wet season. Do come to Northern Australia during the wet season because it is beautiful. It's actually one of my favourites.
Yeah.
The feeling that I get with that. A lot of people come up here and are surprised that it's raining during the wet season.
Yeah.
You might get a few hours every day without the wet, but – experiencing Northern Australia during the wet season and the dry season.
Oh, it's truly wild. And the wildlife is off tap.
It's the best part, eh?
Yeah.
I always say to people, because a lot of people that will visit Cape York in the top end in May to September, and especially more commonly like June to September, it's dry and it's brown. And especially if you come in September or October, like it's really stark. Like you've got a lot of burnt landscape, which is normal up here. And it's still very healthy for a burnt landscape, but it's your blacks, it's your browns, it's dry, it's kind of drab. But unless you see that full circle into the wet season, you see it come back green and life. And I call it the fat, happy, healthy season, because everything, like your birds, your animals, they just bloat. They get fat, they're happy, they're healthy, they're reproducing, like there's babies everywhere. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's such a stark time and everyone has to see it. Plus the energy in the air, like you'd know being locals, the energy in the air this time of year with the thunderstorms is something else.
I love it. Yeah. It's just the wet season for me is, it's just, I don't know. I can't put things into words very well sometimes, but it's one of my favourites.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's energy in the air. There's there's this, whether it's static or build up from the storms or the lightning or whatever you want to see it as, there's some wild energy in the air that time of year.
Well, we didn't get the cyclone. Cyclone Kimmy. She's coming back with a bit of a low. We'll get a little bit more rain that we're used to.
Yeah, it was all look at me. Yeah, and that was it.
It was so funny.
How funny was that, eh? Hey, that's Australian.
That absolutely is. One thing with cyclones, actually, is I've been here for 20 years now because I grew up in Brisbane and I came up here for a holiday, and so 20 years later I'm still here, is now with a cyclone, I'll see what it's like maybe within the 24-hour period before it hits because it's, you know, there's so much like around it, and I've been through so many threats now. It's just like, nah, whatever.
So right, hey, yeah. I was saying the same thing to my roommates last night. One's from Argentina, and they were like, "Oh, nothing happened to the cyclone." I was like, "Yeah, most people that lived in this area, if it's a 1, 2, or 3, it's kind of like, eh. If it's 4 or 5, then people take it seriously. But if it's 1, 2, or 3, people are like, oh, it's just going to get a bit windy. We might clean up some junk in the yard, but that's about it.
Yeah. And usually, like what the Kimmy was, it's like, let's go down here, then up here, then across here, then over there, and then up there. It's just so unpredictable. And, I mean, one thing with Northern Australia, and you would actually have noticed a big difference over the last 24 months with the cyclone damage of certain parts of the Cape there, it really does create a bit of havoc within our environments. But like it isn't as natural as possible. Like it's a natural thing to happen. But one of the areas, where is it? Up north where the Greens are. I've just got a complete...
The Iron Range.
Iron Range. Got a complete mind blank. Have you been through there lately? I've heard that there was quite a bit of damage from
Cyclone Trevor. Cyclone Trevor sat on top of the Iron Range National Park for like 4 hours.
Oh.
And if you got the canopy of the rainforest and took it off and then put it on the ground, that's pretty much it. Wow. Yeah, really, really thick, heavy undergrowth. Changed the dynamics a lot of the wildlife there.
Okay, interesting.
So I definitely don't want a cyclone to hit Cairns itself because we just have so much beautiful rainforest surrounding us. I just don't want to think. I mean, Yassi and... Who was it? Oh, man.
Larry.
Caused a bit of damage down at like Mission Beach Way and Cardwell and all that. And the rainforest down there really was affected. And when you drive through that area, you can see where the vines have just taken over. And for people who can look at a forest and know the cyclone damage just by looking at it with the vines, it can cause a lot of problems. So we definitely don't wish it upon ourselves.
Yeah.
People who get excited about cyclones and they're like, yeah, cyclone party. It's like, no, but for the whole of our environment, it's...
Maybe we should get a cyclone expert on here one day.
Yeah.
That'll be interesting. All the cyclone chasers.
Get them on. If anyone's out there that knows them, let us know. That'd be cool.
I read one of their posts the other day and it was so technical. It was talking about how they knew that the cyclone was going to downgrade.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, there's vertical wind shear and this and blah, blah, blah. And, yeah, and but they knew and they were like, it's definitely going to do this and it's definitely going to do that. But it was more than like the bomber explaining. Like they give you the details, but they were like, this is why. And I was like, oh.
The education behind it. But I have heard that a direct hit on Cairns because of the mountain ranges that we're looking at right now is a little bit more rare.
Okay.
I've heard. I don't even know if that's true, so maybe I could
ask. Well, the Great Dividing Range comes closest to the coast at near the Daintree.
Okay.
Yeah, but, along the Port Douglas Road.
Yeah, but you would also think, like, a lot of the cyclones that have hit kind of Cardwell, Mission Beach area, there's still the range there.
Yeah, but it's so not as close to the coast. I think it comes across and then shifts down. But in saying that, I can't even spell Bureau of Meteorology. I wouldn't have a clue.
Well, on that note, thank you so much for coming to hang out with us this morning. We've had sunbirds, we've had the crickets going crazy, we've had drizzly rain, it's been beautiful. And we will get you back on because I feel, well, I'm just going to be selfish here, I would love to know more of the history of Cape York and that area.
Yeah.
Can you light a fire?
Oh, mate, I could light a fire in 21 different ways.
Okay, I'm going to be the man here and say, well, you know what, so can I. But the truth be told, I'm terrible lighting a campfire. Oh. Tony feeds it to me every time I try and light a campfire.
Here's one fact for everyone listening. Do not ever use leaves to light a fire. Ever.
I'm 30 years old and I'm just learning this.
Yeah. Yeah. What? Leaves just don't work because they smother. They don't let the oxygen in. There's not enough space.
Damn.
And so you put a pile of leaves on and there's no oxygen moving in.
All right.
Grass. You've got to start grass and then this tiniest twigs you can find and work hard.
Done. Yeah. I am going to light the fire when we get you over for a campfire.
Ripper.
In the backyard.
Yep.
And we're going to start the podcast when I start trying to light the fire.
Fantastic.
And I'll see if I can get it going in the podcast.
And then you can talk
It's an hour podcast. I should be able to get it going.
And then we can have a chat about some of the history of the Cape.
And I'll be sitting there going,
sticks, leaves. While you're trying to light a fire.
The meat's gone off that we've harvested from the day. You can't cook it anymore.
So, Rossi, how can we find you, mate?
You can, like, by all means, everyone, please, if you have any questions about this or you want to talk about, you know, getting outdoors or anything, feel free. Like, I love talking to people and helping people find their way or whatever. So, yeah, find me on either Instagram or Facebook on Cockatoos. So, like the bird cockatoo, but cockatoos, one word. Facebook or Instagram is probably the best way to reach out, or you can email if you really like. But, yeah, we also have a website, cockatoos.com. Yeah, Instagram, Facebook, there's a lovely profile, lots of lovely pictures to look at on Instagram. But yeah, feel free, by all means, please reach out if you have any questions about anything you've heard or anything that
how to light a fire, how to take a photo, and how to hunt a pig with a bow.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, any of the above. Yeah, be more than happy to share.
This has been a great Aussie chat. Like,
it has.
How much more Aussie can you get?
I'm just going to say one thing. Struth. There we go. That's my contribution. Yeah. I almost got through a whole podcast without saying it.
Love it.
It was amazing, everyone. I'll put all the links to Rossi's details in the podcast notes, so please make sure you check that out. Otherwise, we will see you back for this wonderful fire and history chat.
That sounds amazing. Thanks, Jones. Thanks, Matt.
Excellent. No worries. We'll talk soon.
Wow, I absolutely love that chat. Thank you so much, Rossi, for dropping by. If you would like to connect with Rossi, you can find him on all of his socials as well as his website, cockatoos.com. I'll put all the information in the podcast notes for you. But I really want to mention again Rossi's Step Outside program, which is so important more now than ever for our youth to get them away from that technology and connect them back with nature and therefore themselves. As you would have heard, the conversation that I had with Rossi did allow us to go quite deep into some realities of life. And I love those kind of conversations. They are heartfelt, they are heart-centered, and they are real and vulnerable. So thank you so much, Rossi, for allowing me and also yourself to show up in that way. I really did value that conversation. Now, if you would like to hear anything specific, or you might know somebody who would love to come on our Wild Chats, I would love to showcase you and also collaborate to help educate everyone about Australian wildlife, whether it's a conservation project, sustainability, maybe something specific about an Australian animal, please connect with us. Again, you'll find the information in the podcast notes. Otherwise, everyone, take care, have a wonderful week, and we'll be back next week with the next Wild Chat.